Several areas of America's lower 48 states are experiencing extreme
weather.
The kind
of flooding we're seeing here is in neighborhoods and on streets.
We'll see emergency crews to rescue people from floodwaters using kayaks.
Inescapable heat, floods, heavy storms,
and
tornadoes.
He and his family got out when
As
they did.
As schools struggle to recuperate from extreme weather, experts say they must better understand their future risk and rebuild more resilient structures.
For many, the impacts of climate change feel distant. That wildfire probably won't hit me. That hurricane is too far away. I can't get flooded. But as the storm of the century becomes the storm of the year or season, more and more, we need to make our communities even more resilient to natural disasters exacerbated by climate change. Fortunately, federal agencies are quite aware of these evolving climate-related challenges, and they've been strengthening coordination around climate resilience as we try to adapt to a new future where the climate has already changed. These efforts around climate resilience take shape in our transportation, businesses, and yes, even our housing.
We love seeing communities that are thinking about where to place new housing, but also what they can do with their existing housing and community buildings, how they can focus on addressing the challenges they have.
That was Marion McFadden, the Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary for Community Planning and Development at the Department of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD. And yes, I know you may not think of HUD as the top agency leading efforts around climate change, but Marion and her agency do amazing work at the intersection of climate resilience planning and affordable housing. So today on Empathy Effect, the Forest Marsh Media podcast that explores the human side of government, let's learn about how housing and climate resilience intersect. And I know that we all want a good roof over our heads, security from the elements, and a dry basement. So Marion will walk us through HUD's role in helping us weather the storms of climate change and learn how we can make our communities more resilient together. Thank you so much for being with us here on Empathy Effect today. I know that climate resilience is a pressing issue, especially in terms of our infrastructure and housing. But before we get started talking about HUD and climate resiliency, I want to spend a moment getting to your roots. You started off your career out of law school, wanting to get into affordable housing. What drove you toward that mission work, and how did you eventually dovetail that passion around climate change and housing?
Well, I started my professional career right out of law school working at HUD, but I would say I actually started many years earlier when I was volunteering in soup kitchens and working with people experiencing homelessness and starting to focus on what happens in a person's life when they don't have a safe place to lay their head at night. So when I came out of law school and had the opportunity to work in HUD's Office of General Counsel, I was excited to work on programs to address homelessness, but also broader community development programs. And when I had been at HUD for about a year, 9/11 happened, and HUD received several billion dollars to assist in the recovery. And that put me down a path of focusing on disaster recovery grants. And over the years, those grants moved away from terrorism toward natural disasters.
Definitely. And, you know, climate change and climate-related disasters have been accelerating at the same time as housing has becoming less and less affordable. You've done a lot of work in developing both affordable and sustainable housing. So have you seen these challenges evolve over time, and how are they intertwined?
I would say I feel fortunate to be working at HUD right now in the Biden-Harris administration, because the Office of Community Planning and Development here at HUD is working at the intersection of climate change and affordable housing. And I think those are two of the most pressing issues of our day here in America.
They definitely are. And, you know, especially since climate-related disasters have been, you know, becoming more frequent, more severe. And amid some of these disasters, you've helped with recovery and resilience in the aftermath of hurricanes like Harvey and Sandy, Katrina. How have you seen communities build resiliency, and what does this look like from both a technical and social perspective?
Well, the thing that impresses us most is when communities are focused on building forward, not building back to what they had right before the disaster struck. When the federal government gets involved in disaster recovery, there is a real opportunity for communities not just to address what happened, but on the broader scale, what that community needs to be stronger. And so that includes looking at economic forces, looking at the location and the stock of housing that's affordable to people making the lowest wages in the communities, thinking about the needs of elders. So we're really fortunate when we get to work with communities that have already been thinking about that. And more with increasing frequency and intensity of disasters, we see people paying attention and thinking about, wow, this could happen in my community. Let's get ahead of it. But for many years, that wasn't the case. And so people would be very, very surprised when disasters happened and then start thinking about those challenges. So we've been lifting up the opportunity to use community planning dollars that we provide to bring together the people who work on affordable housing, managing floodplains or doing emergency management, to get all the big minds and communities focused on using all the resources that are available to build for what could happen, so that if, you know, kind of the worst happens and a disaster comes to your town, you can be protected from it as much as possible.
Yeah, pulling together those resources creatively to be resilient is really important. Over time, I'm curious if you can share an instance when the urgent need for resilient investments really crystallized for you. Like, was there a kind of disaster where you saw a community wasn't prepared or one that was prepared? What does that look like?
I would say Hurricane Katrina really changed my life, seeing the challenges and the goals of the federal government in being able to show up for the communities that were impacted in the Gulf Coast, the failure of the levee, the way that it was impossible to meet the expectations of survivors by providing funding quickly. And so that really impacted my mind and got me thinking about ways that we can provide those supports. And the field of disaster recovery, sounds a little funny that that's a field, but it is, has changed a lot since Hurricane Katrina. So at HUD, we learned about structuring the funds that we put out so that we ensure that someone is back in a home that's safe when they get their keys back or when they move into a new home. We were not as focused on that at the time because we didn't know what it would necessarily look like to see a whole community through a rebuilding process.
Now that, you know, you've seen this sort of solidification of these better efforts to build back stronger and to rebuild in these more sustainable, resilient ways, have there been instances where you've seen a vulnerable neighborhood or community that suffered from a disaster sort of build back stronger and recover quickly or show its own resilience in a way that has been impactful for you and the way you consider your work?
Yeah, absolutely. There have been many, but I would say the first one that comes to mind is Springfield, Massachusetts, which had a terrible series of events, but really did a good job in bringing people together to ensure that they would have resilience that came out of the rebuilding process. So in 2011, they had a tornado that left a 6-mile path of destruction through the city. It took out and damaged nearly 900 homes, and they had apartment buildings that were impacted. And they decided early on that they weren't just going to put back what was lost, but think about building what the community really needed and using that disaster as a catalyst for citywide revitalization. So by 2016, they had renovated or replaced tons and tons of those homes, had replanted more than 4,000 trees. If you think about a tornado, part of the damage is destroying trees. And those protect the street and the homes from ice and storms and rain and heat. And they didn't just stop there. They came into HUD and they competed for and they won a competitive grant to support the creation of an urban watershed revitalization zone.
Nice.
And really just kept the momentum moving forward.
I mean, that's just such a perfect example of how lots of people don't think that these disasters will hit them until it does. Who suspects tornadoes hitting Massachusetts? Normally people think, you know, Kansas, Wizard of Oz kind of stuff. So now I want to actually take a moment to talk about your office. We've talked a lot about your experience now and what you've seen across the field. While we talked about some of the work that HUD has done in terms of climate, lots of people may not look at HUD and think, oh, you know, they're very hands-on with climate change. They'll think about programs and policies that address housing and community development needs. But your branch, the Community Planning and Development branch, does some intersectional work in this space. So can you introduce what exactly your group does for our listeners and explain the work that you do around climate resiliency?
I certainly don't blame anyone who doesn't know about HUD's environmental justice and climate change work. When I first started at HUD and we got a disaster recovery grant, I literally turned to one of my colleagues and said, wait, HUD does disaster recovery? So it's not the biggest part of our brand. People think about maybe public housing or mortgage insurance or the homeless assistance programs that we put out. But one of our biggest programs is called the Community Development Block Grant, and we provide formula funding every year to about 1,300 communities, so states and territories and cities of any large size. And they get to make choices about how to use that funding. But sometimes after the worst disasters, Congress comes forward and says, we are going to give you a special appropriation for one specific disaster or for a series of disasters. And like the regular community development funding, people of modest means are the primary focus of the use of those funds. So all of the work we do is centered in low to moderate incomes. And in thinking about the disaster recovery work over the years, we focused on the disaster resources and created stronger building standards, for example, for when you're using disaster funds. But as we looked at the increasing frequency and intensity of disasters over the years, we started thinking about, well, why should there be different standards for rebuilding after a disaster? So these are some of the questions we're struggling with now and how we think about our floodplain building requirements or some of the other ways we make funding available. And so we're working with all communities, providing toolkits and giving them opportunities to think about building stronger.
Prior to your current position, you were actually very hands-on with your branch's grants. How have you seen those grants developing more resilient and robust communities? Can you provide some examples about how these grants you've shared can continue to grow to support communities that face ongoing problems with climate change? Where can you see grants growing? Where can they improve? I'm just curious to see where you've seen things go.
Well, in my last job, I worked at a nonprofit organization called Enterprise Community Partners, which works all over the country to advance affordable housing, including green building and disaster resilience. And so I was fortunate to get to travel to many communities that were using HUD funding and looked at how the HUD funding was being used to support little nonprofits to help them build their capacity to do their work locally, as well as cities and counties and states who needed some additional expertise. And one of the things that I love best about that job, I love best about this job, which is the chance to help individual communities learn what other places are doing and really take a look at, you know, in the field, we call them best practices, but see what innovations are going on that are working. So some of the things I love to see are communities that are doing disaster recovery, but using that opportunity to create jobs and help their workforce think about where we're going as a country. So focusing on green infrastructure, for example.
I'm kind of curious from, you know, that kind of perspective you've been in, just going around seeing communities addressing their own needs. What kinds of best practices or strategies have you seen in developing resilient and affordable housing? I know that some people have considered reforming land use and zoning, you know, nature-based solutions or other disaster recovery tactics. So what have you seen that is really taking things to the next level?
Yeah, all of those things are really important. So thinking about if you're doing new construction, where are you building? Is this going to be an area that's going to be prone to disasters? Is it going to be hard for people to get out in the event of an emergency? But also thinking about things like, okay, if it's affordable housing, are the residents going to have access to transportation? Some of the daily factors that impact people's lives and their resilience. So we love seeing communities that are thinking about where to place new housing, but also what they can do with their existing housing and community buildings, how they can focus on addressing the challenges they have. Sometimes it can be as simple as planting trees to deal with extreme heat, or painting the roof, coating it with a light material to deal with extreme temperatures, in using new materials to make upgrades to buildings. Sometimes with flood-prone areas, you just need to move your systems from the basement to the roof to ensure that if the worst flood comes through, you can get back online more quickly. So there are building-level solutions as well as community zoning or siting decisions that can be made.
I feel like a really big piece of all of this, too, is that underserved and poor communities are often most vulnerable to climate change and disasters, and they may often not have the tools to rebuild in a resilient way. In cities, for instance, people of color tend to live in heat islands, making climate resiliency important for not just acute disasters, but the day-to-day life, as you were sort of talking about. How are you and federal partners factoring disparities and environmental racism into building climate resiliency, and how can we better support those who are most vulnerable to climate change?
The people who are most impacted by these disasters are the people we think about first in doing our work and making our resources available. You know, we see that people with low incomes are the quickest to be hurt by disasters. It could be in the emergency response side because they lack personal transportation, so it's just simply harder to get to a safe place when something happens. But it also could be because they're living in a home that hasn't been modernized, and so the condition of the property is difficult. It also could be because they are where they can afford to live is property that's known to be subject to damage, like on a riverbed, for example, it's known to flood, and they can afford it because it's less desirable. So thinking about the ways that those decisions impact how someone's going to be able to survive a disaster are the starting point for us. But then when we think about the long-term resilience and recovery process, we think about the months to come or the years to come, we want to make sure that communities that are most impacted understand how to shape the use of the funds. A core component of the HUD Community Development Block Grant funding, including the disaster recovery funding, is community feedback. So we provide funding to levels of government, but they need to hold public hearings. They need to put draft plans out. They need to consult with individual populations. We want to focus on ensuring that communities know how to do that and how to influence those decisions. The president has put out an executive order around addressing environmental justice in minority populations and low-income populations. So we're working across the interagency to give life to those principles. And we've put more than $11 billion last year in meeting the Biden-Harris goal of having 40% of the funds' overall benefit flow to disadvantaged communities or communities that are marginalized, underserved, or overburdened by pollution. So it's really a partnership between folks on the ground, their elected officials or the people running those funds, and the federal government. So I would just emphasize, we're starting by thinking about the most impacted people.
I appreciate you mentioning that and also highlighting some of these larger strokes that the administration is making to address climate change and environmental justice. As we've sort of been talking about throughout this conversation, climate change impacts our lives in so many different ways, from transportation and housing to, you know, our capacity to cope with natural disasters, and it takes an all-of-government approach. And so when it comes to taking that multi-agency approach to climate resilience, how are you working with other federal partners to build a strategy that syncs your collective work around climate and disaster resilience, especially with that equity lens?
I can't agree with you more. It takes an all-of-government approach, and I'm really proud that that's what we're doing now. That's what President Biden has tasked us with doing, is everyone coming to the table who has any role in working with communities to identify how we can do this work better. So we have regular meetings at the White House where we talk about the resources that we bring and how we can move them more quickly and get more equitable outcomes in the work we're doing. And so that means in the disaster recovery context, for example, working with FEMA, the Small Business Administration, and other federal agencies that are involved in that rebuilding process. But it's even bigger than that in thinking about the climate impacts of the work that we're doing. So really across the government, we're looking at all the funding we're putting out there and the way we convey requirements in using that funding to ensure that we are thinking about the impact on the environment and therefore the impact on people.
I know that other partner agencies like FEMA and the Small Business Administration get disaster funding built into their budgets, but with HUD, it's not quite the same. Your agency largely relies on Congress to provide funding when they deem it necessary when emergencies hit. So can you speak to how this impacts your ability to play a part in that all of government approach to climate resiliency and, you know, maybe where you'd like things to change?
We get funding every year to provide to communities, but we only get disaster funding when Congress determines that they should give us a special appropriation of funds. And the president has said we need a permanent, reliable framework so communities know about long-term recovery. So they can tell, is HUD going to come to the table with funding? And so we're very excited about the prospect of getting a permanent CDBG-DR program. Congress has bills and has worked on that in both the House and the Senate side on a bipartisan basis. So I'm optimistic that we'll get a permanent program. But in the meantime, we're doing absolutely everything we can within the authority we have. For the very first time under Secretary Fudge, we put out a request for information for the public to tell HUD how we're running our program and how we can do it better.
Then
we asked a series of questions from the formula we use to put money out to the way that the funds actually hit the ground and how we can achieve more equitable results, because we know there's room to improve.
Definitely. On that communication front, do you think that some communities may have a lack of awareness about, you know, how they can build resilient communities? You know, many people may not, as we talked about, think of HUD as a resource. Do you think that there could be more communication and education and outreach to help make folks more aware? You know, what do you see the role of engagement really playing in helping communities get what they need?
Engagement's essential. We can't possibly do enough of it. It's something we're very focused on. We created a citizen participation and equitable engagement toolkit for the jurisdictions that receive HUD funding so that the folks who work in City Hall or in the State House kind of can get a little extra push to do an even better job working with impacted populations. But we've also put out a series of information, including written information on types of hazards, right? So whether that's a flood or extreme heat or some other stressor that's impacting a community, knowing what can be done. And we really get into some technical suggestions. And not everything has to be really expensive. Certainly, if you have an existing building and you want to elevate it in the case of flood, that's going to be very expensive. But there are very affordable things that can be done as well.
We talked a little bit about your work with other agencies, with communities, but, you know, industry partners are also key for helping bring solutions to the table. So what role do you see industry partners playing in helping us build our communities more resiliently to climate change? What is their role?
Climate change is an area where people can get overwhelmed really quickly. Some people would say it kind of snuck up on us how fast the climate is changing and how quickly we need to act. But something that I find really encouraging is that people are getting it now. People are understanding that choices need to be made every single day that are going to impact the climate. And that includes the public sector, the private sector, individual choices. It's been great to see the private sector coming forward with new technologies. If you look at Hurricane Maria, for example, and then the recovery that's being supported by the federal government, there are going to be a lot of investments. There already have been investments in renewable resources. So I was recently in Puerto Rico at a hospital center, which there's actually 17 different hospital buildings, and they're doing a huge infusion of solar power to support those hospitals. And that's only possible because of private sector innovation and making the technologies available and affordable for this kind of work.
Right.
So we just all need to be thinking about this. And it's so great to see the innovations happening at all levels.
I can't agree enough. And in many ways, the government is helping those partners sort of bring those solutions to the table. And speaking of solutions, I want to chat a bit about Puerto Rico, where, as you might know, hurricanes have been hitting pretty hard. What is HUD's response and support like there? And can you talk about some of the work you've done alongside Puerto Rico in your position?
I've been in my job for about 6 months now, and I've already been to Puerto Rico 3 times because my office is providing $20 billion in funding, and I want to ensure that it's being used as intended. And I want to know where the federal government can do a better job of making those funds available and providing technical expertise so that they can reach the people that was intended. And you can't do that from Washington. You got to get out and meet with community members and meet with the people administering the funds and understand how the federal government can get some barriers out of the way.
While we've discussed a lot about your work in this field and what HUD does with climate change and housing, it's a good time to mention that the Biden administration has been a huge backer of work around sustainability and resiliency. The Inflation Reduction Act is historic in the amount of funding it provides to tackle climate change. And even in the State of the Union address, President Biden mentioned that he wants to continue prioritizing rebuilding communities in sustainable and resilient ways that also address affordable housing. So how do you see the White House's push to address climate change manifesting in your agency's climate resiliency work? How is it really making a difference compared to previous efforts? Maybe that all-of-government approach is enhanced. What do you see happening?
I would start with, in the last 2 years, this administration has put more than $25 billion on the table for investments in energy efficiency, electrification, reducing greenhouse gas emissions for single-family and multifamily homes. There are tax incentives. There are lots and lots of ways for people to get in the game. If they haven't been thinking about climate, there's funding available now, including at HUD. We have funds available through the Green and Resilient Retrofit Program. We're going to put a notice out soon of how to apply to work on multifamily affordable housing. So we're making funds available as we have them, but also doing the education events and making those resources available for people to say, what does this mean here where I am with the town or the building that I'm responsible for, so that everybody really knows that there are things that can be done that you can do. And when you make those choices, you are making a difference in the kind of life that you have every single day, as well as potentially reducing the risk that you'd face from climate change.
Yeah, I guess I have a two-pronged question here. Climate is so daunting. What are some of the biggest challenges with resiliency, especially since climate change is evolving so rapidly? And amid how overwhelming and daunting this may feel, what keeps you personally driven and motivated to keep pushing forward?
I think part of the struggle is that reasonable minds can differ about choices. So what building materials should be? Where should we be building? Is it enough? Are we reducing carbon fast enough? But what keeps me going is that we're moving in the right direction. We're making good choices now with what we have in front of us, and we're continuing to learn while we also have private sector innovation going on in the tools that are available to us to bring down the cost of using renewable energy, for example. And it's inspiring to me to look to younger people, because there are folks of every age who know this is important, but I think it's really the young folks that are driving the conversation in lots of ways and saying, this isn't negotiable. We need to make changes, and we're willing to do what it takes to ensure we're making good choices for the climate.
Can't agree more. Seeing young people these days really just like rally around this, it gives me hope too. As we wrap up today, I was wondering if there are any plugs or resources you want to share with your listeners. You touched on so many different programs that you have. So if there's anything you want people to walk away with, now's the time.
Well, we just got our fiscal year 2023 funding. And at the end of February, every time, HUD will announce the formula allocations going to communities all over the country for programs like the CDBG program, Community Development Block Grant, or the HOME program for affordable housing. They all require a planning process. So my plug would be, look at where the funding goes in your community and reach out and weigh in on how those funds are being used. Say that you want those funds to be used in a way that considers climate change.
That's so important. People often forget that they can make a difference right there in front of them. They don't need to go banging on a door over in Washington. So thank you so much, Marian. It's been so lovely talking with you. I can't wait to see what your office does next. It's been a really great conversation.
Thanks, Melissa. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here.
I think it's important as we walk away today to remember that community engagement piece. People like Marian at the federal level are really trying to hear your thoughts and ideas about how they can help make your homes, neighborhoods, and communities resilient and affordable as the climate crisis evolves. By engaging, you have the power to shape how your community develops, rebuilds, and to see where your federal dollars go. So please do advocate for your community to invest in a better, greener, safer, and more equitable future. That's all with Empathy Effect today. Thanks for tuning in, and I hope you'll join us next month as we gear up for National Public Health Week. The past few years have been tough on our public health system, so next time, we'll learn about federal efforts to strengthen the public health workforce and help us better support those essential frontline workers.
Empathy Effect is a product of Forest Marsh. You can reach us at Forest Marsh Media at forestmarsh.com with any feedback, questions, or inquiries.